I next met with Dr. Heather Wakely, and to begin, she commented on an important Phase 3 trial just reported in June at the ASCO meeting, evaluating the use of adjuvant treatment with the tyrosine kinase inhibitor gefitinib.
So the adjuvant trial is what they called it. It was a Chinese oncology trial, CTONG study, was designed to look at the question of for patients who have a EGFR driver mutation who have been through surgical resection and now are post-op adjuvant treatment setting, are they going to be better off treated with an EGFR TKI, and they used gefitinib in this trial, or platinum doublet chemotherapy, and they used cisplatin vinorelbine standard dosing for that. So it's an interesting research question. The Japanese have an almost exactly similar design study, which we expect to hear about in the next year or two. I'm going to back up for a little bit before I get to the data from the adjuvant trial to talk about the background here, which is that we don't have a lot of randomized studies in this setting. We have some non-randomized trials like the SELECT study where patients who had an EGFR driver mutation after resection, after chemo, if they were going to get chemo, got EGFR TKI, in that case, erlotinib, and they actually had a long disease-free survival, and you didn't really see progression happening or relapse happening until after the 2 years when they'd stopped drugs, so that was really intriguing. Then we have only one adjuvant trial that looked at adjuvant erlotinib, and in that study, the randomization and enrollment was actually based on EGFR expression and not whether or not patients had a mutation, and so the subset of patients with mutations ended up being reasonable, but not enough to be a definitive phase three. So there, patients received chemo or not appropriately, and then were randomized to get adjuvant erlotinib or placebo. And in that study, we had clear benefit from a disease-free survival endpoint, but there was no overall survival benefit, and it wasn't definitively sized to give us an answer. So a lot of questions remaining about what do we do for these patients? We know they have an EGFR driver. We know that EGFR drugs work great in the metastatic setting. So what about adjuvant? So this study, getting back to where we were at ASCO this year, the adjuvant data, this was the first study that was a randomized phase three, big study, just for patients with EGFR mutations, trying to ask that question, do we give EGFR TKIs or not? So that trial wasn't a huge study. It was a little over 100 in each arm. One of the key issues with the trial, one of the kind of flaws, was that they actually enrolled a huge percentage of patients with N2 disease. So about two-thirds of the patients actually had N2 disease, stage 3A. And that's a big issue when we think about the study design because patients were then randomized to either get gefitinib or to get chemo, which means half the patients with stage 3A, you know, two-thirds of the trial was 3A, they didn't get chemo. They were only getting gefitinib. And then if you look at the group that did get chemo, was randomized to chemo, 20% of them didn't get the chemo. So there's a big chunk of patients that didn't get any treatment at all. And that's going to be a big issue when you think about a 3A patient population where there's a really high risk of relapse. Other than that, and not just demographics, the study was run well, and patients either got their 4 cycles of chemo or got their gefitinib. And when we look at the endpoint, the disease-free survival did strongly favor the patients getting the gefitinib, but we don't have any overall survival data yet. And I really think it's important to think about the fact that when you're dealing with adjuvant, you really have to think about cure. If we're not improving cure, just delaying relapse, if it's not changing the survival, we're really not helping patients because they're ending up treating a lot of people who aren't getting any benefit at all. And this is a long-term treatment plan. It's usually a couple years. So to me, even though it showed the primary endpoint, disease-free survival was clearly met with gefitinib versus chemo, I'm not thinking this should be practice changing at this time, and I would really encourage people to be looking for these patients post-operative with EGFR mutation and thinking about enrolling them on the Alchemist study. So that's a big cooperative group study in the U.S. It's enrolling now. Patients are screened to look for EGFR or ALK. If they have EGFR, then they're randomized to get erlotinib or to just get best supportive care after their chemo if they're going to get chemo, after radiation if they're going to get post-operative radiation. But at that time point, when they finish their definitive treatment, then they get randomized to either get erlotinib or just to get best supportive care. The same with ALK, only then they're using crizotinib versus best supportive care. And that study also has, for patients who don't have EGFR, don't have ALK, They then can go on the Anvil portion where they're randomized to get nivolumab or not, so they can then get a PD-1 inhibitor. So it's a really good study, The Alchemist, and I would really encourage, you know, this is open to pretty much any practitioner in the U.S. because it's through the cooperative group network, so it's very, very open, and that's, I think, a much better plan than going out and giving EGFR TKI to these patients after surgery.
You know, I thought it was a really interesting design. I was really surprised by it, comparing it to chemotherapy as opposed to comparing it yes or no after chemotherapy. And I mean, okay, if you really had a trial that you believed in that showed better progression-free survival than chemotherapy, like why would you use chemo? I mean, why would you think it would have a survival benefit if it doesn't even have a progression-free survival as a deficit?
So I think you've really got to think about the idea of cure or not cure. I mean, if we look at the data that exists so far, the disease-free survival was improved. The way I think about it is the patients who were cured by surgery alone were cured by surgery alone. And the patients who were not cured, when you give an EGFR TKI, you're not actually curing. You're postponing when the disease starts to show up again because basically you're giving them their first line of EGFR TKI early as opposed to when you can actually see the disease. But for those patients who didn't get the EGFR drug, who then did recur, they then got their EGFR drug and they sort of made up the difference, right? They're on treatment later as opposed to being on treatment early, but in the end, the survival ends up being the same. So that's how I think about it. Is that the truth? Well, we don't have enough data to say that definitively. But if you look at the earlier studies that we have where you have a disease-free but not an overall survival benefit, that rationale makes sense, where you're not curing, you're just postponing when the disease shows up because you're initiating treatment earlier.
So continuing with the what happened at ASCO theme, any comment on some of the data presented there looking at combination checkpoint inhibitor therapy, particularly in small cell and mesothelioma?
So the checkpoint inhibitors, single drugs, second line, you know, we've got responses in maybe 20% of people with a benefit over single chemo and non-small cell. Small cell, it's still a bit mixed. Responses have been a little bit lower. Meso variable in the trials so far, but probably it's safe to say somewhere in that 20% range also. So that's not great. It's good. It's something. So the idea being that, you know, you've got your checkpoint drug, PD-1. So you're working at that PD-1, PD-L1 interaction, basically at the site of the tumor and at the immune activating or activated cell. And that's one area. But with the CTLA-4 inhibitors, you're actually hitting at a different checkpoint. And that's where you've got your antigen-presenting cell teaching the immune cell, this is the antigen to look for. So if you've got a block in, you know, the negative regulator there and then a block in the negative regulator when the immune cell actually comes over and attacks the tumor, then you're hitting it two places. So theoretically, you're going to have better response. And that's been consistently seen. In pretty much all of the combination trials, you do get a boost in response. You get variable boost in progression-free survival. I think we don't know enough yet to say clearly yes on overall survival or not. You also get a boost in toxicity, as you would expect, because you're then cutting out two places that should be negative regulators preventing autoimmunity. And so when we look at the data in sum that we have with nivolumab and ipilimumab, I've been convinced that it does increase the activity, but also increase the toxicity. And so the question becomes, do we get enough extra benefit to overcome that increase in toxicity? I think the randomized phase 2 study that was done in meso, the MAPS2 study, was a bit more convincing as far as showing increase in benefit. The response rates were up a little bit, definite progression-free survival benefit, and the OS benefit seemed to be there, though it wasn't significant yet. So that was encouraging. There was an increase in toxicity. They did have some toxic deaths, so you've got to weigh it. But in meso second line, we don't have as much there. For small cell, again, we don't have phase 3 data, so we have to be careful. Phase 2s, we've all seen randomized phase 2s that look great, and when you go to phase 3, it doesn't pan out. But I think there are hints there. It's interesting that we have NCCN guidelines saying that we can do this in small cell, give that combination, and I've tried it in a couple people. The non-small cell data, I think there's still a lot we're trying to figure out there. I have thought about it in some patients. I was impressed with some of the response rate improvement. Absolutely, though, the toxicity is there too. So I don't know that ASCO gives a whole lot new other than that randomized study in meso. The small cell data was interesting also, but nothing that I think is totally practice changing.
So another thing that was presented at ASCO I was curious about, there were a couple of papers looking at TDM1 in HER2 mutant non-small cell. And up till now, I really haven't gotten much of a feel about whether any kind of anti-HER therapy really works in these patients. What did you think about the data on TDM1?
I'm encouraged by it, but sort of mixed. So I actually have a pretty good cohort of patients with HER2 mutations. And so I have had experience giving afatinib, which has HER2 activity from a TKI perspective, as well as just giving trastuzumab in combination with chemotherapy, either docetaxel or vinorelbine. And I've absolutely had great responses to those.
Well, have you had great responses to anti-HER therapy without chemo?
Yeah. Well, like I mean, so I've never given trastuzumab by itself, but I've given it in combination with docetaxel in someone where you would respect a not great response rate, and also in vinorelbine where really don't see much response rate at all, where we've seen really good partial responses. So I believe that there is activity, and with afatinib as a single agent, I've definitely seen activity. The challenge is, when we think about our patients with EGFR or HER1 mutations, you give them a targeted drug and it tends to work for close to a year. When you give afatinib with a HER2 mutation, it hasn't lasted as long in the literature and also in my own experience. When you're adding trastuzumab to chemo, I've had a couple patients with reasonable duration of response, but again, it's far from what we would like it to be because these often are younger patients, otherwise healthy. You know, you're really trying to push and make sure they get activity. So the TDM1 trial that was done in patients with a HER2 mutation, I found intriguing but a little disappointing. The response rates were not as high as I'd like to see, nor was the duration. And I've tried it once outside of a trial setting for a patient who'd already been very heavily pretreated and didn't have activity. I think it's absolutely worth further exploration. We need better drugs in that setting. There are a number of tyrosine kinase drugs that are actually in development now in clinical trials for the HER2 mutation patients. And I think it is a true driver mutation subset that needs better activity, you know, needs better drugs. So TDM1 exploration will be important. It wasn't a home run, but it was interesting. The other trial was looking just at patients that HER2 expression, and that, I don't think that's really the direction we want to go. I think we need to think about it is when there's a true driver mutation, then we want to be hitting HER2, and TDM1 might end up being a good drug there. Maybe, I don't know if it's going to be first line, second line, third line. Probably we're still better off with chemo for first line right now. How is it going to fit in with afatinib and with trastuzumab plus chemo? I don't think we're there yet, but it's important to keep going with those studies.
So one other question, and then we can maybe go through your cases. And getting back to patients with targetable mutations, we were talking about HER2. How do you approach right now the integration of checkpoint inhibitors into the sequence of therapy of metastatic disease in patients with targetable mutations, not just EGFR and ALK, but the less common ones, including RET and HER2?
So that's a really important question, and I think it's one that community oncologists need to really be hearing and thinking about. I always emphasize that if a true driver mutation is found, whether it's ALK, whether it's EGFR, whether it's ROS1, whether it's one of those others, that is a much more critical pathway to be thinking about than immune checkpoint inhibition. And to remind people that if you look in the details of the first line trials that looked at checkpoint inhibitors versus chemo, patients with known driver mutations were excluded, so they're not in that group.
Could I just clarify, you said known driver mutations. Is that the case, or was it just ALK and EGFR?
They just looked at ALK and EGFR, but from my perspective, the other drivers, especially like HER2, those are going to be similar biology. And to me, those patients are much less likely to respond and really should get their targeted, or they should get chemotherapy if it's not EGFR and ALK. They should get the targeted drug if they're EGFR and ALK. I think we still have a bit of a gray zone for RET and MET and some of these others that, you know, you're asking about. We don't really know, but it really kind of depends on the patient there. And PD-L1 is not the full story. I think we've all learned the story with pembrolizumab that if you have greater than or equal to 50% TPS on the 2-2-C3 assay for PD-L1, that those patients should get pembrolizumab as a single agent first line and then later can go on to other treatments. And I think when you don't have a driver mutation, if it's sort of a classic lung cancer patient, that makes sense. But when I'm seeing a young patient who doesn't have a heavy smoking history, The PD-L1 level to me is not nearly as relevant because there are other factors besides PD-L1 like tumor mutation burden, total mutation burden, and a lot of other factors that we probably don't even have names for yet that play a role. And so when I have a patient like that, and I've actually had a number of them recently who comes in, they got their PD-L1 level back, but we don't have their mutation status back, I am absolutely not rushing to start them on pembrolizumab. I'm retesting, looking until I'm convinced that we know that their mutation status is not having a driver mutation. And even then in that group, the young never smokers, they're the ones I think more about maybe this combination of chemo plus checkpoint inhibitor as opposed to checkpoint inhibitor alone. That's the only subgroup I'm really thinking about it in. But then my practice is a bit unusual, and those are my patients. And I know a lot of other folks in practice don't see patients with lung cancer who fit that demographic as much. So getting back to your question about, well, okay, patient has a known driver mutation. Where do we fit in with these checkpoint drugs? PD-L1 level to me isn't as relevant in that setting. If they're EGFR-ALK, I'm going to start on EGFR-ALK therapy. And now I'm going to give them a second line of EGFR and ALK therapy or ALK therapy because we know that we have those drugs now. And then third line, I'm probably going to go with chemo because chemotherapy works really well in that group of patients. And each time we're adding on more treatments, we know that the complexity of the tumor is probably increasing, and therefore theoretically increasing the likelihood of having a response to a checkpoint drug because it's not just the PD-L1. When we get to a fourth line, I'm usually going to, you know, think about a checkpoint drug at that point or look for a trial. The data so far of combination tyrosine kinase drugs plus checkpoint drugs has been a little bit of a cautionary tale. We've not seen a lot of data. What we've seen has mostly been some toxicity warnings. And so I don't do that off trial, but I think it's important that we continue to explore that on trial. So to kind of simplify it, first line, if there's EGFR-ALK, I don't go with checkpoint drugs. Second line, I still stick with the targeted. Third line, I usually do chemo. Fourth line, I absolutely will try the checkpoint drugs. And I have seen a few patients with benefit in the EGFR setting. I haven't yet in ALK, but I don't think that means it doesn't work. What I have noticed, though, is a lot of the ALK patients do have high PD-L1. So if it's first line and I get a high PD-L1 and it's someone I'm worried about likely has a driver mutation, I don't just look at that PD-L1 and run with it. I double check the ALK and other status. Just I actually got a result back today on a patient who I saw a week and a half ago or 2 weeks ago now who came in, had high PD-L1. She was 45, never smoker. She had pericardial metastases and brain metastases. And I looked at her and I'm like, you probably have ALK. We need to wait and retest this because the first FISH test was negative. We got a blood test. It didn't give us an answer. Repeat biopsy. And I just found out yesterday she does have indeed an ALK translocation. So she's going to start on alectinib and I think is going to do much better with that approach than she would with either chemo or starting with a checkpoint inhibitor.
That's interesting. How did you pick up the ALK if she was FISH negative?
We repeated the biopsy. We did it. You know, none of our tests are perfect. So if you've got a high enough pretest probability, you've got to repeat those tests.
Repeat FISH.
Yeah, it was a repeat FISH in her case. We'll usually go to NGS at that point.
Well, that was I was going to ask you. I have heard cases that were, quote, FISH negative, NGS positive. Have you seen that?
Yep. Definitely have some of those. This was a patient I was co-managing with an outside facility. So if it was at my facility, I would have done NGS at that point.
Interesting. So that kind of leads into sort of the question of the day, I think, which is first-line therapy in non-squamous cancer that does not have a targetable mutation.
Right.
And now, since the late May approval of the combination of carbo, pembro, and pemetrexed, that's out there on the table. I asked if you would pull a case from your practice where you considered or even used it. But first, maybe you can just talk a little bit about how you're kind of thinking it through in general right now.
Sure. So I think, as you alluded to, in a patient who has non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer, you're convinced they don't have a driver mutation, and you're always going to get PD-L1 testing now with the 2-2-C3 assay. If it's 50% or higher, I'm very comfortable giving pembrolizumab alone in that setting. Otherwise, you're then left with the question of chemo by itself, chemo plus bevacizumab, chemo with pembrolizumab. Where do we go now and how do we choose? I think chemotherapy alone is still a very standard approach and very appropriate with or without bevacizumab, you know, depending on the data or sort of the patient characteristics and your thoughts about bevacizumab. The pembrolizumab data, I think I was very shocked, and most of my colleagues in academia I've spoken to have been quite surprised with that FDA approval, quite honestly, because it was a small, randomized phase 2 study that didn't even have a survival benefit. And if you look into the details, the highest responses were in patients who had a TPS of greater than or equal to 50%. And their response rates to the 3-drug regimen was over, close to 70, 80%. And that's really encouraging. And we've seen similar kinds of numbers when you look at other checkpoint inhibitors, like there was atezolizumab with the carboplatin pemetrexed, similar. So they think that might be real. But the question becomes, does that higher response rate with increased toxicity really translate into an overall survival benefit compared to pembrolizumab alone? And we don't know that yet. So for that group, I wonder if it's really over 50%, do I really need to add the chemo? I think if someone has a really high tumor mutation burden, like lots of liver disease or other areas, and I really need that response more than just the longer-term benefit, that's where I'll think about it for that group. When you look at the details for the subset of patients that had the 1 to 49% TPS, and you look at the response data, it actually was not better with the 3 drugs compared to the chemotherapy alone. And so in that group, I'm not sure that we're adding much by adding in pembrolizumab at that point. Again, it's only randomized phase 2. Having been taking care of lung cancer patients and doing lots of trials for over 15 years, been through a lot of randomized phase 2s that look great that in phase 3 didn't pan out, so I'm a bit hesitant to change practice based on a small subset like that. It's the patients that had very low levels that seem to benefit again. And then you have to wonder, why is it that low had benefit, high had benefit, and intermediate didn't have any? Without a clear rationale, it's harder for me to really believe it as the truth. So I'm really looking forward to seeing the data that's going to come out from the bigger trials. And those trials are ongoing, so it's not like we're going to be waiting years. We should be getting that information relatively soon. So even though we have the FDA approval, I'm not recommending the 3-drug regimen often, but that doesn't mean I've never recommended it, right? So it does become something we can talk to with our patients about and sort of decide with them if this makes sense for that particular individual.
So maybe you can talk about this 33-year-old lady that you took care of.
I had this clinic day last week, which was a bit unusual. I had 3 new patients, and 2 of them were under 50, never-smoking women who came in saying, and my tests were all negative other than my PD-L1 was relatively high. And they both had brain metastases. One had had whole brain radiation before she came to see me. That was this patient, the 33-year-old. The other one was supposed to start it the next day, and so I paused it for the one who was about to start it so we could get the mutation testing back. And that's that patient with ALK I just mentioned earlier. This other one is this 33-year-old woman. And so she still had tissue left. So we went ahead and sent it off to Foundation Medicine. And there are a lot of good NGS companies now. So Foundation and Caris and Garden. And, we have in-house, a lot of places have their own in-house. So, I don't want to be brand specific with that, but we ended up sending it to Foundation for her. And it came back and she had an intermediate tumor mutation burden, but did not have a driver mutation. And so I've got a 33-year-old woman, never smoker, with widely metastatic adenocarcinoma of the lung, which is, of course, unusual, but seen, no driver mutation, and high PD-L1 of 80%. And so she's someone where pembrolizumab alone would be a reasonable answer, but she has a pretty high tumor burden, and I'm just still, even though we didn't find the driver, she's just someone where it doesn't feel like the pembrolizumab alone is necessarily going to truly hit a high enough response rate. I think there's enough other data suggesting that that subgroup of patients is not going to benefit as much from the single agent. So she's the one where I did recommend doing the 3-drug regimen. I knew she would tolerate it, and I thought it would increase her responses. But there was a lot of debate about that.
You mentioned increased toxicity, but is it your take that you kind of see the individual 2 toxicities just at the same, on the same patient?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think the combination of chemo plus the checkpoint inhibitors is sort of 1 + 1 = 2. But when you look at the tyrosine kinase inhibitors plus the checkpoint inhibitors, it's 1 + 1 = 3 or 4. And why? I don't know that we have a good answer for it. I mean, there's a lot of theories behind what's happening with PD-L1 expression relative to tyrosine kinase drugs or how they may be interfering in the immune system. Otherwise, I don't think we have enough of an answer to do anything other than hand wave right now.
Although, you do see pneumonitis with TKIs. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's sort of a direct quote, drug effect and not an immune pneumonitis, I imagine.
Well, I mean, pneumonitis is an inflammation, so it is triggering an immune inflammation. Whether you can look at it as, well, it's related to the drug, but that's the etiology. They still respond to steroids.
Right. Okay, well, why don't we talk about a couple of your other cases? Maybe we can talk about your 46-year-old lady with EGFR mutant disease.
Sure. So this is a patient who was diagnosed with EGFR exon 19 deletion, non-small cell lung cancer with brain metastases and a lot of bone disease. I think her initial diagnosis was about 4 years ago now. And so when she first presented, it was with nearly a cord compression and she actually went in for surgery. Then they found this EGFR mutation and she was started on erlotinib. She did reasonably well with it for about a year, but had a lot of challenges with rash management, which she found quite lifestyle altering. So that was really hard for her. She then developed leptomeningeal metastases. And at that point, we didn't yet have osimertinib approved, so weren't able to go to that at that point. She didn't really want to get whole brain radiation. We actually started her on carboplatin and pemetrexed, initially with some bevacizumab also. And she had a really good response. So it kept her leptomeningeal disease at bay, had a good control of her disease, and initially she did well with that. Continued to control disease, but she was gradually having more issues with fatigue and just not tolerating the chemo, and then started having increasing headaches and some lethargy. And we found that she had a significant progression in her brain with more brain metastases, as well as with recurrence of the leptomeningeal. So at that point, and this was about a year and a half ago now, she ended up needing whole brain radiation because of the size of the brain metastases. I do tend to delay whole brain radiation as long as I can, especially in my patients who are younger and older, but especially those who have a driver mutation, just because I've had enough of them who've done well for a number of years that I do worry about the longer-term cognitive loss from the whole brain radiation. And I've had just a couple patients, but I remember them very clearly, who we were able to get their disease really well controlled, but 2 years later, after their whole brain radiation, they started to develop cognitive deficits related to the brain radiation and actually died from that as opposed to their disease. So I'm kind of on the extreme of trying to avoid whole brain radiation. But when you need to, you need to. And so for this patient, about a year and a half ago, she needed it. She got through it, did okay. And then by that point, we had just gotten the approval for osimertinib. And so she was able to start on osimertinib and has continued on that to this day. I just saw her actually on Monday. She looked great. She still has, her hair used to be very, very long. Of course, after whole brain radiation, it's come back shorter. But she looks lovely. She's active. She's, you know, goes to the gym regularly. You wouldn't know she was someone who was sick. So is that going to keep going? I don't know. She's already been on osimertinib a year and a half. We know that the average is less, but they're always outliers. And so right now she's looking like one of those outliers.
Any tolerability issues with osimertinib with her?
Not for her. We do have to watch patients for cardiac toxicity with the drug. It's something we're not used to thinking about with the other EGFR TKIs. So in our practice, we've had one patient who did end up having some issues with cardiomyopathy that we think were drug-related to the osimertinib. So we do get regular electrocardiograms on our patients at baseline after the first 1 to 2 months, sometimes earlier if there's any question, and then like every 3 to 4 months after that. And we will get echocardiograms again at baseline, within the first month, and then much less frequently if they're not having any symptoms. So we do watch. It's pretty rare, but not zero. There still is some rash. Most people find it pretty tolerable, especially those who've had bad rash issues with erlotinib or gefitinib or afatinib. So otherwise, it's a pretty well-tolerated agent. Most patients who are on it do feel overall like their quality of life is better than when they'd been on the other EGFR TKIs, but it's not completely symptom-free.
How about this lady? How did her experience, particularly in terms of rash and the side effects, compare osimertinib, and she had previously been on erlotinib?
So for her, the rash on erlotinib was much, much worse than what she's dealing with osimertinib. The osimertinib rash for her is pretty negligible, so she's very happy with it.
Can you talk a little bit about where we are in terms of mutation testing in the EGFR setting, specifically T790, how you approach this issue, particularly in terms of the use of plasma? I don't know if urine is still something that's, you've done research on that, but I sort of heard that that's not moving forward, but you can maybe clarify where we are with that.
So when we're dealing with a newly diagnosed patient, most of them have tissue, so that's straightforward, though we do have an FDA-approved plasma test, a COBAS test for the sensitizing mutations. When the osimertinib approval came through with the T790M requirement, the COBAS testing expanded to also include T790M, and so that's actually approved. It's not quite as sensitive as a lot of the other commercial assays out there, and in our practice, usually we have tissue testing, so we don't always get initial plasma testing, but if we don't get an answer from the tissue, we will get plasma and then repeat tissue. When someone's been on an EGFR TKI for a period of time and then are progressing, that's where we usually will start with a plasma test. We send it out to various different places as well as we have our own in-house assay, which is about to be CLIA certified, but isn't yet, so we're still sending out as well. If we find T790M in the plasma, I always believe it and feel like that's a good reason to switch someone to osimertinib, assuming that it's time, right? They might still have slow progression and we'll wait, but osimertinib will be next step. If I get a test back and it shows the driver mutation, but not the T790M, I tend to believe that's a true negative and that these patients have some other resistance mechanism, and I'm not as inclined to think about osimertinib. If they come back with a test that shows neither the driver nor T790M, then it's not a good test. They either aren't shedding enough tumor DNA or we missed it somehow. And those are patients we have to decide, is it worth getting a repeat biopsy or not? So that's my practice pattern. I think there's a lot of variability in that, different levels of comfort with the plasma results and interpreting them. The urine testing, unfortunately, I thought, it's a good assay, but there are always business reasons to go into things too, and so that's not moving ahead as far. And in a setting of patients who have lung cancer and are coming in regularly and getting blood tests anyway, not having to do a blood draw isn't such a big improvement as it would be in someone who wouldn't otherwise need to get a blood draw.
Just to clarify, though, in the upfront setting, if you see a positive plasma assay, you believe it, treat, and don't think about tissue, correct?
Well, we always have tissue, and so that's still the gold standard, but we're trying to get results as quickly as we can when someone's newly diagnosed. So if I get a positive plasma test, I'm going to go with that. And oftentimes those results do come back faster than the tissue testing because you don't have to do all the upfront processing.
And if it's negative, I assume you want to see tissue for sure.
Right.
But in the relapse setting, in terms of the issue of T790, that approach that you just mentioned, I really don't remember anybody mentioning to me. So it makes sense. So you're saying that when you get a plasma assay, You could see the EGFR mutation, but not the T790?
Well, sometimes. So all of the assays that are developed, they're not just reporting on T790M. They're also looking for the primary driver mutation. In addition, they're looking for T790M. And if you think about what's happening, you don't lose the driver. You just add the T790M onto it. So what you're looking at as sort of your control is to see, can you find the known driver mutation? If you find that, and then you don't find T790M, it makes you think that probably the biology is something else is going on. But if you don't find either of them, then maybe there's just not enough tumor DNA or you're not detecting it well enough. There are slight differences in the sensitivity of the assays. So in general, the deletion 19 and L858R assays are a little bit more sensitive than the T790M assay. So there will be some patients who really have T790M, but you don't see it when you find the drivers. But usually, if you have the driver, the primary driver, and you find it, T790M positive, you believe it. T790M negative, you believe there's another resistance mechanism. But if you don't find either, that's where I'm more inclined to think about doing a biopsy. Does that explain it?
Yeah, it does. But so you're saying that when you send off the plasma assay in the T790 negative case, It reports out as EGFR positive.
So they will report it out and say, we found L858R, for instance, but we did not find T790M.
Interesting.
That's how those assays come back.
Interesting. The other thing I want to ask you about, this patient specifically seemed to have a really good response in the CNS. What do we know about osimertinib in the CNS and indirectly by comparison to the other TKIs?
So the osimertinib CNS activity is really equivalent to the systemic activity. So if you look at the response rates, they're around 70% for patients with a known T790M mutation. That's from the AURA 3 and the earlier trials as well. So that's been a pretty consistent number. They just at ASCO presented the brain-specific updates related to osimertinib activity, and it was very, very similar to the patient's activity sort of elsewhere. So if it works systemically, it works in the brain. Last year at ASCO, we had the Bloom trial results, which was specifically for patients with leptomeningeal disease. They were giving a higher dose, so it was at 160 milligrams as opposed to the 80 milligrams, but had clear evidence of CNS activity with leptomeningeal activity in patients getting that 160 dosing. So they showed clearance from CSF. They also showed clinical improvement. So I have absolutely used this in patients with EGFR, with leptomeningeal disease, and been impressed with their responses. They're not all as long as this patient, but there certainly are good responses in addition to just this one in my practice.
What do we know about osimertinib and EGFR T790 negative disease at diagnosis up front? I know there is a trial comparing osimertinib to erlotinib up front, but what do we know in general about the activity in that situation?
So we don't yet have the results from the FLORA trial. So that's the first line, erlotinib versus osimertinib. Rumors are that maybe we'll hear something about it later this year. I'm not involved in the study, so I don't know for sure. However, when you look at the upfront response rates, it's fairly similar, maybe a little bit higher. What we're looking to see is, will the progression-free survival time be in excess of what you would get with erlotinib followed by osimertinib? I think that's really going to be the question. If you get an osimertinib first-line progression-free survival that's only about 15 months, it's hard to argue that that's necessarily better for the patients than starting on erlotinib and then adding on osimertinib, where you would predict somewhere roughly around 22 months. Of course, these are medians and it's always different for each person, but you know, those are kind of the magnitudes that we're having to look at. Now, some of the early data with osimertinib first line hinted that it might be in excess of that 22 months. And so I think we just need to see the data to know. If it's in excess, that'll be the way we go. If it's not, then I think there'll be differences in practice. Part of it's going to be around the brain also. Almost all the EGFR drugs, and in fact, all the ones we have, do have good brain activity. I don't know that we've had enough head-to-head comparisons yet to say that one's definitely better than another. Clearly, in the resistance setting, osimertinib's our drug. That's the one that's approved. It's the active one, and it absolutely works in the brain. First line, they all have activity in the brain. So I don't know that we can distinguish between them.
We were talking before about the trials in the adjuvant setting. I think osimertinib's also being looked at in the adjuvant setting.
Right.
Where do you think things are going to end up? If you had to guess, first of all, do you think that we're going to end up using TKIs in the adjuvant setting? And if so, which one?
That's a great question. I'm not going to give you a definitive answer on that one because I really don't know.
Give me a definitive guess.
Okay. I have concerns about the adjuvant trial that was presented at ASCO this year for the reasons we talked about, that you had, you know, 60% of the patients who went on that trial never got any chemotherapy. And yet two-thirds of them had stage 3 disease where we know chemo could improve cure. So that's my issue with that study. In the adjuvant setting, we need to see cure. We need to see improvements in overall survival and true cure. I have not yet been convinced that we're doing that with the EGFR TKIs. For some patients, delaying that progression might be enough, but not for all of the patients, especially not the younger patients. There, if we're not improving cure, why are we giving them therapy for 2 years when it's not going to ultimately change how they're doing? So if the Alchemist study comes out showing a clear survival benefit, or if in the end adjuvant and the Japanese trial show a clear overall survival benefit, I will switch. But I've not seen enough to convince me that's the case yet.
Well, that's why I asked about which agent, because you would think if it were osimertinib, you know, maybe it wouldn't be that big a deal to take it for 2 years.
There is toxicity, and the cardiac toxicity, while rare and therefore not of such a big deal in people with metastatic disease, if it's more than a couple percentage, that's a significant impact on patients in the adjuvant setting. So I think we need to be cautious there. Just because something's tolerable or relatively tolerable metastatic, where people have a lot of disease burden and a lot of symptoms and really need that activity, very different when we're in a setting of patients who might already be cured.
Yeah, that's another thing. You know, it's just amazing how often I ask people stuff and I still hear new things all the time. And honestly, I never heard about this issue about cardiac and osimertinib. What do we know about that? You mentioned that before in terms of numbers.
So it's small percentage. There is a QTc prolongation, and that's known for this class of drugs definitively. And then very, very low, but not zero, with this cardiomyopathy. I can't quote the numbers off the top of my head. It's there. It's in the package insert. And I mean, it's something that we talk about, but it's rare in metastatic lung cancer patients. That doesn't come up very often because unfortunately not all of them are living long enough to see these issues. It's not always something that happens quickly. The QTc can be, but we know to kind of look at that with EKGs.
Sure.
So it's small percentage. It's just that if you're dealing with an adjuvant setting where you're maybe only helping a few people, if you hurt a couple, then your net benefit isn't really there.
I'm curious about your patient with ROS1. You have a lady in her 40s. Can you talk about her?
This is a patient who I first had met 6-7 years ago when she presented with disease that was occupying a good percentage of her right lung, did not clearly have nodal involvement, and so actually went for resection, but had a lot of disease in the lobe that was removed. So we ended up giving her chemotherapy with cisplatin and pemetrexed, which she didn't tolerate that well, but did okay with. She got 4 cycles. Unfortunately, though, the disease recurred within 6 months, was on the pleura at that point, as well as it had recurred within the lung. And so at that point, we put her back on some chemotherapy. We didn't go back to the exact same drugs, and she did okay for a little while. I think she was on platinum and a taxane. And then as she went on through that, we then found out about ROS1. So we went back and did testing, and we found out that she did indeed have a ROS1 translocation. So then she went on crizotinib, and she actually did pretty well with that for, I think it was about a year, feeling quite well. She then recurred, and then we put her back on chemotherapy, went back to pemetrexed because she really had only had it for a brief time. She did well with carboplatin pemetrexed. And at this point, it actually developed some brain metastases also. So we needed to give her focused radiation, added in the bevacizumab, and that controlled things. She then ended up getting further progression and some leptomeningeal metastases as well. Actually, at that point, we didn't have lorlatinib, we didn't have any other ROS drugs, but we did get her cabozantinib. So cabozantinib is a multi-targeted tyrosine kinase drug that's approved in non-lung cancer malignancies, but has been shown to have activity against a number of the specific drivers, including ROS1. So we put her on that, and she actually did really well. Great response. Came back to full function and did well with that for a period of about 9-10 months. She got to go on a cruise to Alaska she'd been dreaming about for over a year, so that was really nice. But then when her disease recurred the next time, I felt that we needed to give it a try. She'd been through multiple prior regimens. We had a couple of immune drugs approved at that point. So I went ahead and started her after a long discussion about the fact that we don't know activity levels in the setting of patients with ROS1. So she went ahead and started atezolizumab, but unfortunately, very rapidly, within a couple of days, ended up in an outside hospital in respiratory distress, ended up being intubated, diffuse infiltrative pattern. They tried high-dose steroids, nothing worked, and she ended up dying. So that was obviously a sad case. I mean, she'd been through 6 years of treatment, had lived a long time, had been through a lot of things. We didn't really have anything else standard to give her, and there are handfuls of patients with these driver mutations who do respond. So, you know, looking back at it, I don't know that I would have done anything differently, but it just raises that caution that you've got to wait sometimes to start immune therapy until you're sure it's the right time, because if it doesn't go well, sometimes it really doesn't go well.
I mean, that really is a terrible toxicity. How many other cases do you have like that where you have pulmonary toxicity?
I've had a few patients over the years, and we've been involved in trials with these drugs. So, you know, I didn't just start treating them 2 years ago. It's been going back over time. So it's a large N of people who have been treated, but there have been a few who have had terrible pneumonitis and didn't make it despite recognizing it quickly and starting high-dose steroids. So I think we need to remember that there is caution with these drugs. There are other, you know, stories of pericarditis and fulminant hepatitis, and we're still kind of in the honeymoon period with the immune checkpoints, and so you just hear good, good, good about them, and patients come in with good, good, good thoughts about them, and I think there is a lot of good from them, but there's also the underside. There's the toxicity side, and it doesn't yet really get talked about enough. So I think that's the caution. And that's part of why I'm not feeling like we should be putting this in the drinking water or second someone gets diagnosed, just throwing these drugs at them. I think we need to still be judicious in when and how we're using them.
So then specifically in ROS1 right now, today, what's your usual sequence? And in particular, what kind of targeted therapy to use beyond crizotinib?
So when I have a patient who's newly diagnosed with ROS1, I still talk with them about chemo because I've had some fabulous responses with carboplatin and pemetrexed. I have a couple of patients who did so well that they had minimal residual disease. We were able to do radiation, and I've now got two I can think of off the top of my head who haven't been on any treatment at all for over a year, despite having stage 4 disease. So it's hard to forget about those, right?
Just to be clear, though, are you saying, though, that ROS1 is more sensitive to chemotherapy specifically?
Specifically pemetrexed, yes.
Because I've heard that with ALK, right? Mm-hmm.
I think it's even more so with ROS1.
Wow.
So we published on that. It's a small series. You know, I can't give you all the scientific research behind it, but it's just a clinical observation that we've seen and I've heard repeated by others also. So I still think about that. It's not 100%. There's not 100% response rate, but it's pretty good. And some of those responses are striking. But we also have the crizotinib approval. I think crizotinib is a very active drug in ROS1. It's not like EGFR where your responses go on and on and on. It's maybe a little better than ALK, but it's going to work for the time it's going to work. And unfortunately, without this as much brain activity, has some, but it's not as good in the brain. I think we've now seen some data from a Korean trial with ceritinib and ROS1, where that also looks to be active as a first-line TKI. I wouldn't recommend going from crizotinib to ceritinib the way we do in ALK. I don't think that response rate's the same that we have with the ALK story, but I think ceritinib's a reasonable thing to think about instead of crizotinib for ROS1 patients. Again, it's only phase 2. We need more data, but it was encouraging. I have been impressed with the cabozantinib data in ROS1. So there's very little in the literature. We're working to get our case series written up because we've been able to use it in a number of patients with some very good responses, some quite durable. I think the lorlatinib data is looking quite good also, and hopefully that drug's going to be more readily available fairly soon for the ROS1 patients.
Lorlatinib?
Lorlatinib, yeah.
Is that an ALK drug, or what is it primarily?
So it's being developed primarily as an ALK inhibitor for patients who have been previously treated with other ALK inhibitors, and there were some nice updates at ASCO this year about it. They didn't present the ROS1 subset at ASCO this year, but they presented some of it last year, and it's looking encouraging, so that's a promising agent also. There are a lot of the other ALK drugs that also have ROS1 activity, and there are some that don't. Like, alectinib does not have ROS1 activity, so I think we need to be careful that we can't think of all ALK drugs as also being ROS1 drugs, but some ALK drugs are also ROS1 drugs. And so, you know, there's more we're learning there because it's a smaller subset, so there hasn't been as much research. And then, like I said, chemo works. We don't know about the immune-targeted drugs very much. The only molecular driver subset that we really have enough data to say anything is with EGFR, where we know that the response rates are relatively low, like probably less than 5%. We don't know as much about it in ALK. The suspicion is it's going to be perhaps even lower than that. We don't know much about ROS, though probably also fairly low. So there's a lot we still need to know about ROS.
I think Memorial presented some data, though, on exon 14 and checkpoint inhibitors, suggesting it was kind of like EGFR.
So the MET exon 14?
Right.
Yes, they did present that. I have one patient who was on a atezolizumab clinical trial. So she's been on it for, I think, was over 2 years.
Wow.
And when she progressed and we needed to move on to something else, we went back and retested her tissue because we had never come up with a definitive driver mutation. And she ended up having MET exon 14 skip mutation. So I just started her on crizotinib. We'll wait and see how she's doing with that. But she was on atezolizumab for an extended period with clear disease control. So like all things, there are always going to be exceptions to these rules. I think there's more we need to know about the checkpoint responses with most of our driver mutations. But we need to look. And if you do find the driver mutation, that's probably more relevant for the patient than the PD-L1 expression.
couple other points related to the case. You were talking about the pulmonary toxicity this lady experienced. But in general, what has been your experience with pulmonary toxicity? It seems like, and specifically in lung cancer, because these patients often have a lot of tumor in their lung, they might have chronic lung disease, it gets to be a little bit of a diagnostic dilemma. You have a patient on a checkpoint inhibitor who starts getting more short of breath.
Right. The times that I've had patients where I'm quite convinced that it was the drug, they were rapid, usually rapid after the first treatment, and with diffuse pattern and often very, very severe. At least one of them, she responded very well to steroids. So again, then it was very clear it was a drug reaction to the checkpoint inhibitor. But it can be confusing, especially if you have a patient with a high disease burden in the lung. They could get a pneumonia. They've already got COPD. There's a lot going on. So it can be confusing. But I think we do patients a disservice if we assume it's anything else and don't start them on high-dose steroids. Because if it is pneumonitis and we start the high-dose steroids, we have a chance of having recovery for them. And if we don't, we miss it, they're not going to recover.
You also mentioned that this lady early on in her course had received adjuvant chemotherapy, CIS-PEM. You mentioned she had some problems. Could you provide an update on your adjuvant trial that actually looked at bevacizumab? But you've also reported some interesting data in terms of the type of chemotherapy that's been used. What are the latest findings from that study?
So I presented that at ASCO 2016. It's about to be, well, we're working on getting it published, nearly there, not quite. So what we presented was that bevacizumab didn't add anything in the adjuvant setting to lung cancer. It didn't decrease, didn't increase. It just sort of, the lines were right over each other. What was interesting about the trial that we did intentionally was instead of mandating one specific chemotherapy regimen, we mandated the cisplatin had to be 75 milligrams per meter squared once every 3 weeks. But then we had four different chemotherapies that could be used as the added to the cisplatin backbone. So docetaxel, vinorelbine, gemcitabine, and then later we added in the option of pemetrexed when that became approved as a first-line combination regimen. And it was interesting to see sort of the choices that the practitioners used, because the overwhelming majority of patients were getting the pemetrexed and cisplatin, even though that didn't become available until 2 years into the trial, and even though it was limited only to the non-squamous patients, which was not the entire study. We had squamous patients on the trial as well, about a quarter of the patients. So it was very interesting to see this uptake, and I think it has to do with the toxicity mostly. Patients with pemetrexed and cisplatin, they still can have low counts, but it's not as frequent as with docetaxel or gemcitabine. They don't get the alopecia, which when you're dealing with only four doses of chemo for 3 months, you don't want to then end up having to deal with that hair loss and, you know, years of trying to get it back to what it looked like beforehand. And people say, oh, well, that's just a vanity thing, but it's not. It's a lot about people's perception of themselves and their illness and sort of trying to recover. So I look at that as being a substantial issue. The other toxicities, you know, fatigue and whatnot with pemetrexed, that's real, but it tends to happen more with longer-term regimens as opposed to the four doses. So people found that it was, in general, better tolerated, and we showed that also. We looked at sort of all grade 3, 4, 5 toxicity and showed that that was lower with the pemetrexed regimen than with the others. So it's what I tend to think about for my patients with adenocarcinoma. Obviously, with squames, we wouldn't use it, and then you've got gem or the taxanes. Using vinorelbine, there's certainly much more evidence in that with that combination from the other adjuvant trials, so perfectly reasonable. So people choose, but because of the toxicity and practice patterns, at least in the U.S., we're using a lot of cisplatin pemetrexed.
Anything else you want to talk about in terms of your own clinical research interests in lung cancer?
So that's a great question. I think we're all at this point, I mean, with my patient population, I see a lot of patients with EGFR. I see a lot of patients with ALK. And so a lot of our trials are focused in that relatively small subset. You know, if you look at globally what's happening with lung cancer, really excited to see that we have a third generation drug. And now we're focusing on what can we do after osimertinib. We haven't gotten there yet, but there are hints of some drugs that are showing some promise there. I'm really intrigued by how are we going to get the immune regimens to work in patients with the driver mutations. Again, I don't think I have an answer there yet, but we're looking into trials sort of in that realm as well, and same with ALK. We're also, I think the adjuvant, we still have a lot of questions there, and I really, you know, I pushed for the Alchemist study already. I'm going to push for that again. There are also other trials looking at checkpoint inhibitors in the adjuvant setting, and there are a lot of those, and I think those are going to be important. and questions also about whether we should be thinking about giving the checkpoint drugs before surgery, hints of data. You know, we had a 20-patient study that was presented again this year, was also presented last year, that's just a couple of East Coast centers that looks intriguing.
You're talking about the neoadjuvant study.
Neoadjuvant, right. So I think checkpoint inhibitors, neoadjuvant, adjuvant, we need to look at those questions, and there are a lot of studies there also. And I think where there's a lot of work and kind of overwhelming amount is in what do we do when you've done a checkpoint inhibitor single drug and then it's not working. So we talked a little bit today about the CTLA-4. There's a lot of interest in the IDO inhibitors, some small data sets, but intriguing that were coming out at ASCO this year also with response rates in the mid-30s. And then there's a lot of other things. And so it's hard to keep track of what's really going to be the most promising, but trying to be focused there and getting more studies and also making sure that the trials have the correlates to help us understand which patients are the ones really benefiting.
Yeah, that was the thing that I wondered about with these neoadjuvant studies, and I don't know to what extent it's been looked at, which is the issue of, you know, looking inside the tumor before and after neoadjuvant checkpoint inhibitors. Anything that's been done in this arena or anything you'd be interested in seeing?
So that's a very hot question. We actually have one of our fellows at Stanford who's very focused on that particular question. And I know that I think every major academic center has at least one person very interested in that particular question. Looking at the tumor infiltrating lymphocytes is obviously part of it. But then really exploring the details of those tumor infiltrating lymphocytes a bit more. So you're just like, oh, there's a lymphocyte under the microscope. But really trying to question it with some of the newest lab technologies where you can get a lot more detailed information about what those cells are doing and what particular antigens are looking at, perhaps even to that level of detail, more around like what pathways are activated and not. So I think there's a lot of interest in that right now.
So we were talking before about the issue of checkpoint inhibitors of small cell cancer. There's also an agent I wanted to ask you about, antibody drug conjugate, which we have a couple in oncology nowadays, brentuximab vedotin in lymphoma and T-DM1 in breast cancer, Rova-T. Can you talk about what that agent actually is and what we know about it?
Sure. So it's an antibody drug conjugate, as you mentioned. And basically, it's an antibody that's recognizing a particular antigen that's seen on a lot of small cell. And the antibody is not just a simple antibody, but has this sort of warhead attached to it, which is a very toxic agent, which we couldn't give systemically, but you can give systemically this way because it's got the antibody attached to it. So theoretically, the antibody is only going to go to the sites of interest like the small cells, small cell cancer, and then that's going to bring the toxin in and that's going to just kind of kill locally. There are some other toxicities seen, neuropathies and pleural effusions and things like that. But in general, they've taken these really, really toxic molecules and made them much less toxic by doing this antibody drug conjugate. So the data from the Rova-T in small cell, the responses were encouraging, especially because those were pretreated patients. They were best if you had the specific marker, but the progression-free survival time was not as long as I like to see. Again, it's small cell, refractory small cell sometimes, so maybe I'm asking too much. I think it's absolutely worth further exploration, which they're doing. It'll be interesting to think about some combinations there. You know, we've talked a lot about immune drugs. Small cell immune drugs are looking okay. I think, you know, a lot of us have this impression that part of the challenges we face is trying to get the right antigens released so that the immune system's recognizing the right antigens. And so the idea that maybe if you combine immune treatment with chemo, we've seen that actually looked okay. Maybe if you combine it with radiation, there's a lot of excitement there and a lot of trials. Maybe if you combine it with a great antibody drug conjugate where you're getting release of the right antigens, combining that, that could be interesting. Or you might end up setting off a terrible toxicity cascade too. So I think that it's worth further exploration with that. The drug by itself is certainly encouraging. We need more things for small cell. Is it a blockbuster going to change everything that we know about small cell? Maybe, but I didn't think so based on the data I've seen so far.
From what you've seen, are the single agent response rates of a clinical nature that you think they'd be beneficial to your patients?
Oh, sure. When something only works for 3-4 months, that's 3-4 months. That's more than not having 3-4 months, but it's going to depend a lot on the toxicities. And I haven't worked with a drug to really have a sense of it. From the presentation, you know, it seemed like it was reasonable, but not non-toxic.
We talked about the issue of checkpoint inhibitors in the adjuvant setting in trials. What about the issue in locally advanced, particularly after chemo radiation therapy? There's a press release out there suggesting there's a positive trial using durvalumab, an anti-PD-L1 agent, after chemo radiation therapy. Any thoughts about that?
So that's the Pacific trial. So we don't know any details other than it met its endpoint. So we don't know any of the numbers, any of the statistics around it, or how it was designed, really. What we know is that patients had chemo radiation and then got the durvalumab, and that it was a positive trial. And we'll know more. The expectation is with that press release that we'll know something at one of the fall meetings. And so if that is sufficiently positive, it has the potential to be practice changing, because we don't have anything to give after chemo radiation right now that's been shown to have any meaningful benefit. This is a curative setting. So again, it'll be interesting to see if we see an OS, overall survival benefit, if it's just disease free. Probably won't be enough follow-up to say anything about survival, overall survival. So then is it enough DFS benefit to warrant change? I mean, hand waving, we don't know yet. It'll be really interesting to see. And then there are questions coming up around the idea of, there's been fear of giving the drugs with radiation because of setting off pneumonitis. There's still been fears in some of the adjuvant trials about giving some of the checkpoint drugs after radiation, and yet this one was done, and at least from what we've heard, the toxicity was manageable. But those will be details we'll need to see from the trial itself.
And I guess theoretically, you have the so-called abscopal effect, or maybe the radiation is going to in some way enhance it, the actual beneficial effect. Of course, we don't know that's the case.
Right. So we don't know. I've had one patient I was convinced had an abscopal effect, but I don't know that it's going to be quite as frequent as we like to talk about it. So,
what was your patient?
Oh, she was a woman with non-small cell lung cancer who had been doing reasonably well on nivolumab for, I think, 9 months, but started having progression in one of her lung nodules, as well as some lymph nodes. So we treated the lung nodule, and the lymph nodes also shrunk.
You radiated the lung nodules?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm, that's interesting.
Yep. Yeah, it was interesting. Unfortunately, she then developed a grade 3 colitis, which we've been battling for a while. But
But she only had radiation to the lung nodule.
Mm-hmm.
She was still on the nivolumab?
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, we held it during the radiation, but restarted it then.
And then she responded in the nose. That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I made a note here. I forgot to ask you, when we were going through the issue of checkpoint inhibitors with squamous cell, I meant to ask you the way you approach first-line therapy of squamous cell in the patients who have PD-L1 levels less than 50% in terms of choice of chemotherapy and whether or not you consider or ever even use necitumumab.
So I tend to start patients with platinum and gemcitabine more often than the taxanes. I use more carbo and less cisplatin, and so I haven't used necitumumab very often. I mention it to patients. I don't have a lot of first-line squamous patients, so it doesn't come up on a regular basis. I do mention it. I don't know that if you look at the cost-benefit analysis that it always makes sense, but I think it's something that we mention. I mean, it's a drug, it's FDA approved, it's in that indication. I think that the fact that the study was done before we had the checkpoint inhibitor, so, makes us all feel like, well, we're going to start with their chemo, and then they'll go to the checkpoint drug. So how much am I really adding with giving this very expensive antibody? And so I think that's part of the reason it's not used as much. I haven't really given it. I will be using it more. We have some trials coming up in EGFR patients where we're adding necitumumab to some of the EGFR TKIs, but that's a totally different arena.
What about maintenance in these patients?
I do sometimes give gemcitabine maintenance. I know there's not a lot of data there. I mean, there's just not that much data there. However, I've had patients who have continued to respond and really clinically seem to benefit by continuing, and so that's what I do.
You mentioned that you don't usually use a taxane, that you prefer gemcitabine. Any comments, though, about the taxanes? A fair number of people use nab-paclitaxel, mm-hmm. particularly in squamous. Any thoughts mm-hmm. about that?
So I think nab-paclitaxel is a pretty well-tolerated drug. They're actually doing a trial looking at maintenance with that, and I think that's going to be an important study when we get the readout from it, because if it does show that with that formulation and tolerability that you're able to keep going and that there's benefit from that, I think that will be important in practice changing for squamous patients. Especially in older patients with the weekly dosing, I find that it's better tolerated than the every 3 week paclitaxel. When I give docetaxel, I often give it weekly also, even though that's not as usual because of that tolerability issue. Where I've used nab-paclitaxel the most is in people who have had a reaction to paclitaxel or docetaxel. It does have a significantly higher price tag, and so that's one of the things I look at when trying to decide if that's the right thing for my patients at this time. But I do think it's a good drug. I mean, it's reasonably well tolerated. It's active. I've used it. I just tend to give the gem more often first line because of the tolerability.